Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share the experience, strength, and hope with each other as they may solve their common problems and help others to recover from alcohol. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There is no dues or fees for a membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. A is not allied with any set denomination, politics, organization, institutions. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help others, alcoholics, achieve sobriety.
And Rebecca will read the steps.
One, we admitted we are powerless over... I'm Rebecca, I'm an alcoholic. We admitted we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we are entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Eddie will read the traditions.
Thanks. Good evening, everybody. My name is Eddie, and I'm an alcoholic. Our 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Tonight is anniversary night. The format of the meeting will be the 10-minute speaker who will speak on the first tradition, followed by our information break. The main speaker who will speak for 25 minutes, followed by our anniversary celebrants, Our 10-minute speaker is Tika.
Thank you. My name's Tika, and I'm an alcoholic. Nervous alcoholic. All right, tradition one. I'm going to read the long form. Each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of a greater whole. AA must continue to live, or most of us will surely die. Hence, our common welfare comes first. But individual welfare follows closely after. When I first came to AA, I knew nothing about alcoholism. I knew nothing about the program. I knew nothing about the traditions. And I was at the Steps and Traditions meeting right off the bat, which is on Friday night on the West Side. And somebody described the program. They gave this little analogy of a fishbowl and a fish swimming in water. And the fish would be the alcoholic swimming around. The water would be the steps because that's what you need to survive. And then the traditions would be compared to the glass bowl that's protecting the fish and holding the whole thing together. So there's a crack or the traditions or the glass bowl breaks, basically the alcoholic or the fish would die. That was like a really, I was very confused when I came in here, and that made sense to me. So I held on to it and stuck into my mind. And then I remember Van talking about if the fellowship was going to die, it was going to die from the inside out, not from the outside in. And, you know, we go out and we work the steps and we, like, nobody's going to go, oh, you know, those AAs, they come in and they're, like, paying all this money back that I didn't even know they stole. And they're, you know, showing up for work. Like, no one's going to come in and try and destroy us. But so if you're new, I'm going to dive. I only have 10 minutes, so I'm just going to talk a little bit about the history. And there were two different groups that helped a lot of alcoholics back a long time ago. And they're no longer really successful at all. One's completely gone, and one's lost momentum. And basically, it's the Washingtonians and the Oxford group. And the Washingtonians movement's no longer around. And if you're new, it's important because we are still around and we want to flourish. So we had to learn from their mistakes. And this group was in the 1840s. They, you know, met in bars. They helped a lot of alcoholics. They, they were incredibly effective. And what they did is they started to get into, you know, other issues, prohibition, slavery, and they disappeared. And then you have the Oxford group, which you know, was definitely an influence for our program. And they made it, there was an offhanded comment about Hitler, and basically they lost momentum severely as a result of that. And so that's why we have these traditions, to help, you know, ensure that we don't disappear like that. I'm going to read a little bit of, because I did a little homework. Back in 1947, this is some writing that came actually from Bill himself, and it's an editorial from, you can find it on the Grapevine. So it's on tradition one. Our whole AA program is securely founded in the principle of humility, that is to say, perspective, which implies, among all other things, that we relate ourselves rightly to God and to our fellows, that we each see ourselves as we really are, as part of a greater whole. Seeing our fellows thus, we shall enjoy group harmony. That is why AA tradition can confidently state our common welfare comes first. Does this mean that AA will ask the individual, that in AA the individual doesn't count too much? Is he to be swallowed up, dominated by the group? And then he says, no, it doesn't seem to work out that way. That there is no society on earth more careful to grant the individual the greatest possible liberty and belief in action. We do suggest, but we don't discipline. Compliance or non-compliance with any of these principles of AA is a matter of the conscience of the individual. Judge not, we observe most literally. Some will argue, if AA has no authority, aren't we going to just be chaos and anarchy? AAs cannot really do as we please. Our common welfare is protected by powerful safeguards. The moment any action seriously threatens the common welfare, group opinion mobilizes to remind us. Our conscience begins to complain. If one persists, he may become so disturbed as to get drunk. And then he says that alcohol will give you a beating. Group opinion shows him that he is off the beam. His own, thank you, conscience tells him he is dead wrong. And if he goes too far, Barleycorn brings him real conviction. And then he goes on to say that basically we wind up adhering to these because we want to survive and we want to stick around and we don't want AA to disappear. And, you know, for me, I have a lot of alcoholism in my gene pool, and I married another alcoholic, so I want AA to be here, because most likely my grandkids, here and there, there may be a need for it. And then there are these wonderful checklists, just to see, I'm going to read them, if we're on the beam or not. Tradition one, here's a question. One, am I and my group a healing or mending integrated person, or am I divisive? What about gossip and taking other members' inventories? Two, am I a peacemaker, or do I, with pious preludes such as just for the sake of discussion, or plunge into an argument? Am I gentle with those who rub me the wrong way, or am I abrasive? Do I make competitive AA remarks, such as comparing one group with another, or contrasting AA in one place with another place? You know, bashing AA meetings is definitely breaking this tradition. Do I put down some AA activities as if I were superior for not participating in this or that aspect of AA? Am I informed about AA as a whole? Do I support in every way I can AA as a whole, or just as the parts that I understand or I approve of? So for me, it's, do I say yes whenever, anytime AA asks me to do something, I just say yes. Am I as considerate an AA member as I want them to be of me? Do I spout platitudes about love while indulging in secretly justifying behaviors that bristle with hostility? Do I go to enough AA meetings or read enough AA literature to really keep in touch? And do I share all of AA with me? Do I share with AA all of me, the bad and the good, accepting as well as giving the help of fellowship? So those are kind of interesting to ponder over. And then I just want to say, you know, for anyone that's new that wants to learn more about traditions, the Friday night meeting is the easiest, most perfect place to learn about them. You get to hear a lot of different people talk about what they mean and how they apply them to their lives. I mean, the first tradition I learned to apply to my business, I work with a team. Like, is my behavior checking, you know, Facebook, helping the common, you know, are we staying unified by doing that? No, you know, I learned to apply these principles to, you know, my life, and it's incredibly helpful. You know, and the GSR commitment that I've been given this last year, it's, I mean, all the work that we do and everything we talk about is we're trying to, you know, we keep in mind the first tradition. I just want to thank Heidi for asking me to speak. And that's really actually all I have to share. So thanks for letting me be of service.
I'm Monica.
Thanks, man. Good job. My name's Eddie. I'm a recovering alcoholic. We good? Thanks a lot, Heidi, for asking me to speak. Thanks, microphone dude, for helping with the mic. Tika, thank you for your lead on Tradition 1. Really helped me to, like, be in a meeting. You know, the fishbowl thing totally blew my mind. And, totally made me forget everything that I was going to talk about tonight as well. So, what do you call it? I am an alcoholic. When I say that I'm an alcoholic, what I'm talking about is I got a physical allergy to alcohol, which is an abnormal reaction to drinking alcohol. When I put alcohol in my blood, it triggers an unstoppable physical reaction that calls for the next drink. And, you know, what do they say is I take a drink, and then the drink takes a drink, and then the drink takes me. And that doesn't happen to just everybody. And the other part of the illness, alcoholism, I have is the mental part, which I come to respect as the most dangerous part of the illness, which is the mental thing that where I can't remember that I can't safely and successfully drink alcohol. And that's just one part of the mental part, which I hope I'm going to talk a little bit about that in recovery. But that being said, this is also information that I didn't have. Somebody could have brought to my attention sooner. Probably not, though. They would have told me. I don't think I would have believed it as a kid. There's a chapter, anyway, I like talking about the book Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a chapter in the book Alcoholics Anonymous called A Vision for You. And this, for me, is one of the best part of all the AA literature. It's one of the things that I come to appreciate now that I've been clean for a little while. But it starts out in this chapter talking about what we used to think about alcohol. For normal people, a normal person thinks about alcohol like this. And it also is what I used to think, the positive association we used to have with drinking. It means relaxation and being creative and connecting with other people and blah, blah, blah. I'd probably be able to quote it exactly what it is once the adrenaline dump like wears off of being speaking in front of what looks like the entire tri-state area is here getting sober, which is awesome. It's great. But anyway, so the fun times, the good times when drinking worked and when it was fun and when it was workable for me, that was when I was 14. When I was 14 years old, I had already been drinking for a couple years, several years, and we drank all this beer in the basement of my friend's house. It was during the summer, and we went outside from something about going from the cool basement of drinking the beers out into the heat of being outside and then into the drugstore where it was air-conditioned and then come back outside, and I passed out. And it was one of those where your eyes are open, but the window shade goes down, and I fell down onto my face. I basically, like, laid down, you know, from a full standing position and just crashed my face into the sidewalk. And I crawled around on my hands and knees, and I crawled around by the edge of the building. I leaned up against the wall. I was sitting down, and that was my I had arrived moment. I felt good. You know, I'm bleeding from the head, and I feel like I'm Clint Eastwood or Butch Cassidy. You know, you light up a cigarette, and you're watching people go by, and I was, and a normal person doesn't have that association, but I remember around that time was when I make the decision I'm going to turn my will and life over to the care of alcohol. And I was in a meeting this afternoon at lunchtime, and somebody said it was life on alcohol's terms as opposed to life on life's terms. And that was when I made that, and I, you know, I like to say it was that day, you know, I don't know, but I know that what it felt like, and it was special. You know, my sponsor likes to say, I'm not an alcoholic because of what alcohol did to me. It's what it did for me that makes me different. And it didn't do that for just anybody. I mean, it was a special thing for me. And the first, looking back now, it makes sense. You know, the first casualty of the drinking lifestyle for me was my education. I was smart. I was supposed to be smart. I was supposed to be a scientist or a professor or something. And what I did was laid siege to my brain cells with poisonous quantities of alcohol and anything else I could get my hands on from the very beginning. And I was shot out. I graduated high school by the skin of my teeth. I graduated high school. They let me get my high school diploma. I had a, like, you know. And I set up a pattern for me that was one of the patterns that ran throughout my drinking story, my drinking career. My drinking career. Which is one of these AA... look it. If you're calling your drinking a career, you got a problem with alcohol, all right? You know what I'm saying? You're like, you're probably an alcoholic. I know it says in We Agnostics what the description of it is, but you can add that, you know. And I learned, the pattern I learned throughout this story is when you get in a jam, I immediately stop drinking. And then I start talking. And I want to think about it, and I'm going to say the right thing, and I talk my way out of it. Let's make a deal. Get on my side. Come on, let's work together on this thing. Whatever it takes to make it right, I'm going to make it right. And I squeaked out of high school, and I went away to college. and things got much, much worse, got much harder to talk your way out of it. And I don't know, what do you want to, it's a horror show, you know, from that point. I got punched in the face when I was in college. I lost my glasses off the balcony or somewhere, and I started wearing my contact lenses. I had a pair, old pair of contact lenses. And the thing about wearing contacts is you're supposed to take them out, right, before you go to sleep. And when you don't never know when or where you're going to go to sleep, you wind up waking up with your contacts spot welded to your eyes, you know, and that, you know, performing surgery every morning to try and get the contacts out. I was still trying to be an artist. I went away to art school. And the thing about the casualties, what happened was, and the real pattern, you could tell the crazy stories and stuff, but the pattern here is that when things got in the way of my drinking, it had to go. So I compromised. When I got to art school, I went from, I'm never going to drink ever again, I swear to God and everybody else, to like, I'll drink once in a while. And like I said, I had the allergy. So I'm off to the races, and it became, I'm not gonna go, I wanna be an artist, so, you know, I'm not gonna go to liberal arts. I'm not gonna go to English or geology. Forget that. I'm an artist. And then after a while, so I'm gonna be an illustrator, so I don't gotta go to photography or, you know, I'll cut those down until eventually I stop going to drawing class and I'm drinking around the clock. I can't go outside while it's still light out. I gotta wait till it gets dark out before I go outside. And at the same time, you see other people start to thrive and explode into like lives. Like, we're gonna get engaged into the community and we're gonna do this awareness and have shows and girlfriends and cook food and things that escaped me. You know, what has he got that I don't got? And he drinks. You know what I mean? So anyway, I got thrown out of art school. And, if you've ever been thrown out of art school, you probably got a problem. It's really hard to do, but, you know, it's not that hard. If you don't go, they tell you, look, you know. And so I moved in with my father and in Brooklyn, in the railroad apartment in Brooklyn, me and my father, just till I get on my feet, just till I get a job and I get an apartment, just for a couple of months, I'll stay with you. And it took over, I think, you know, I think it took about a year and a half, maybe more, before I was able to fully detonate that situation with what he would start to recognize, even from his perspective, was pathological, dishonest behavior. Wasn't the drinking even so much for him, but it was the dishonesty. He knew, you know, and he was shocked. You're looking me right in the face and telling me that, and I look at his teeth. You know, I wouldn't look in his eyes. I would look in his teeth and lie. You know, so I get the gate. You know, I move in with a roommate out in Queens, way out on the F train outside of the city in Queens with a roommate, a bartender friend of mine. And that was a horrendous situation as well. It gets worse. There's a progression here. You know what I mean? It doesn't get better. It doesn't go away. It doesn't, you know what I mean? It wasn't going to pick up. It wasn't, things were not going to start looking up for me. The where I wound up, you know, the end of my story is very like, you know, I don't even know how to talk about it anymore. I used to be more clear. Remember when you're new, you could tell your whole story. It made, now it seems like I don't know. Anyway, I wound up creating an environment for myself in this place in Queens. It was upstairs in a two-family house. I had one room in the back. And the environment that I created for myself was a disaster. I crashed on a futon pad on the floor. It wasn't a futon. It was just a mattress. It was flattened out, and it had turned black from the toxins that I was sweating out of my body every night. And I had an empty case of Georgie vodka that I used as a table. And I would be next to this mattress pad on the floor. And I took a black magic marker and I used to write things on it. I was reading the Bible at the time. I'm reading the Old Testament and the New Testament. Jonah and James and Job and all these stories. And I would pull things out of the text and I would write it in black magic marker on this cardboard case, empty case of vodka, like an escaped mental patient, basically, is how I was living. Thank you. I had like the half empty, containers of Chinese food. The empty tall boys with cigarettes put out on them, mounds and mounds of unwashed clothes. I had, what do we say, the alcoholic method of doing laundry, which is basically like the weight from the clothes on top creates a pressure that cleans the clothes on the bottom. So like, what you do is, you pull, you, as long as you keep pulling out from the bottom, you know, that's the fresh clothes, you know. And I had the, anyway, you know, and I had bags and bags of unopened mail. I couldn't open my mail. I couldn't answer the phone. So, you know, I'm shot. I'm basically shot out. And it was much, much more disgusting than that, believe me. But, you know, you look at Atlantic, it's like, how do you, you know, you don't want to, you know, to that. But what happened was, and here's the thing, the end of my story, I don't even know how much is real at this point, how much really happened, but I'll tell you this much. The salient information at the end of my story seems to be this. I had an employer. One thing was I had an employer that took an interest in me. I was I was working freelance. I was working, what do they call it, independent contractor. And when I didn't work, I didn't get paid. And I didn't have a, anyway, it was crazy. But this employer liked me. For one reason, she took an interest in me. And she was a little wacky. She was a little new agey, but she was tough as hell. And she was cool. People were afraid of her. But I just was magnetized towards this lady, this employer that I had. And she used to look at me and she told me, you know, I like you. You're great. But you know, you're not here. I can't keep you. It breaks my heart. She said to me, you disappear for 3-4 days at a time. I don't know where you, I couldn't show up. So when I bottomed out, I started bottoming out, I called her. Cause, alright, I'll tell you what. I called her why, cause I don't want to lose my job. But what I did was I told her the truth for the first time. And if you answer phones at Intergroup or you work with somebody that's an active alcoholic, every once in a while, you'll get a call like this. And it's amazing getting it from this perspective. But I made that call to her that it's like, it's like the call from, it's a transmission from outer space, basically, right? You're calling from another dimension. It's always these hushed tones. I gotta talk to you. Listen, I gotta tell you something that's very important. I want you to listen very closely. Alright? I think there's really, really something wrong with me. And she's like, who is this? What do you, you know what I mean? It's like, it was like 12 monkeys, you know? If you've seen 12 monkeys, I'm calling from the future. I had a spider and I ate it. It's like, Cole, you idiot, you know? Like, what are you even talking about? And I'm like, I gotta meet you for a cup of coffee right now. And she's like, I am not meeting you anywhere. I will not meet you. I am not gonna see you. And her attitude, she did not have to read the chapter to employers. She knew a person with their head screwed on straight. Her whole situation was, you're going crazy alone. You know what I mean? And she said, you need help, go get help. And that was the beginning. You know, she sent me to see a psychotherapist. And this is the other thing I'm not really square on. I'm gonna try and wrap this up because, you know, here's the other thing that seems to be obvious is that I sit across from the psychotherapist and I'm ready for anything at this point. I mean, I get into therapy, I tell this lady, I describe to her the symptoms of alcoholic depression, which is what I got at this point, right? Boom. And she says to me, and this is the mental part of the disease, this is what blows my mind more than anything else. She says, well, do you drink alcohol, you know? And I'm like, what? Why? What are you talking about? Now, this is after several failed attempts to manage and control my drinking, several honest failed attempts to stop drinking entirely, and she tells me, do you drink every day? And I don't understand the question. I honestly don't understand the question. You know what I mean? I'm looking at it like, what are you driving at? You know, like, what? I'm in therapy. I'm going to kill myself. I'm standing back away from the edge of the subway every day. And I'm saying, give me the pills. Give me the electric shock. I mean, I don't know what you got for me, but this cannot possibly be about drinking. And she gave me a meeting book and she said to go to a meeting and I went and I got drunk and it was around this time I also got 12-stepped and I have to say, Michaela G is a recovering addict and alcoholic who carried the message to me. It was around this time. And she said to me, cause I'm like, I gotta quit drinking. I'm not going to AA, but I gotta quit drinking. She said, I quit drinking. And I was like, really? She said, the easiest thing I ever did was quit drinking. And I was like, and then she said, the hardest thing I ever did was stay sober. And there's a part in Bill's discussion of step one where he says when one alcoholic puts in the mind of another alcoholic the real nature of his problem, that person will not be the same again. And I was not the same after that. And I drank again almost immediately after that, but it was not the same after that. And I walked into my first AA meeting like, I don't know, by my count, it must have been even 15 months after that. And it was horrendous the last couple of whatever it was out there. But I walk into the Mustard Seed group in 1992 and I haven't taken a drink since March of 92. That's my sober date. I got a sponsor right away. I get plugged in, and I guess I got a couple minutes. I want to say the best thing that one of the things that this therapist told me, she said, when you get to AA, find a friend, get one person you could talk to. She knew that I was almost phobic about being around other people, so she said, if you get a hold of one person, you got to get one friend. That was my assignment. And I'm hanging around, and I got a sponsor right away. Steve B was awesome. His girlfriend was amazing. His girlfriend would straighten me out more than my sponsor. She really looked out for me. So I was plugged in, and the fellowship, you want to do it, it's like, how do we say? The fellowship sustained me long enough until I could start to get my teeth into the program. I don't know why, I really even think about my first friend in AA was a guy named Lawrence. We called him L.A. And L.A. had like 2 years. He was a special guy. And that was my best friend. And I heard him share in a meeting. I stuck out my hand and I said, dude, I really like what you said in this meeting. And I followed him around. To me, he was like 007. He was like Batman, James Bond, all. And I thought I was going to be like him. I thought it was appropriate for me to try to be like him. I didn't know, like, I got to learn how to be like myself. But I love this guy, you know. And it was sober a couple of years, and he was up for some charges from when he was out there. He had a court date. And we went out to New Jersey, and we showed some support for L.A. And there was a chance he was going to go right from court directly to jail. It's not like go home. And I was going to say goodbye to my best friend. Batman was going to go to jail. And I was terrified. And we were in the little room, and his attorney came in and said, it doesn't look good. And I'm going, you put me on the stands. I'll be a character witness. And I was shot out of a... Yeah, you know what? That's not a good idea. I was like the human space heater of crazy as a newcomer. And this guy looked out for me. Now he's going away. We went in the bathroom of this courthouse, and we got down on the floor on our knees and prayed. And I remember him praying. He said something. It might have been the third step prayer. But you know what I know what it wasn't. What he didn't say is, get me out of this and I'll never do it again. And he didn't say, please let it be a hung jury, which is what I was saying. Like, let him, like, get off. But he said what we do here. And now the reason why it is impressed on me is that he knew that I was the new guy. And what he showed me is, this is how we do it. This is how we do it. You know what I mean? This is a gesture of step three. So that more than, I mean, we can talk about doctor's opinion, we agnostics, how it works, the formal 1, 2, and 3. But, and you know, I did the Joe and Charlie, the Big Book Comes Alive, and the home group and the sponsor. But this guy showed me, demonstrated right in front of me. And I thought the miracle of that story, that second step miracle, was he got off. But the real miracle is in my first several years of sobriety, when I had the death in the family and my girlfriend tried to commit suicide, and I had a physical injury and chronic pain and surgery. People had to take care of me, and the IRS came after me. I called my sponsor, and I made it to my home group, and I practiced the step I was on. But I leaned back on the experience that I got from this guy, and my sponsor demonstrated to me, said, this is how we do it. When it gets like this, you suit up, you don't drink, right? You suit up and show up, and we go forward. You do not run away. And that, to me, is the demonstration, you know, of what we do in here. The rest of it, what? 4, 5, 6, and 7, personal house cleaning is tremendous. You know, it's important. I was out in the Park West group, and I heard somebody share that if you're like me, you know, like many of us, you come in here, we got these tremendous ego and very low self-esteem. And what I thought, and what she said, what I felt like is, I thought that my gigantic ego was self-esteem. And I thought my low self-esteem was humility. Right? And it turns out, that's not how that works. Alright? And 4, 5, 6, and 7, for me, that personal house cleaning is, write down on a piece of paper the truth about yourself. Talk to another human being about the truth about yourself. 6 and 7, you spend that time in prayer and meditation, you start to deal with the truth. So I have more, better information about who I am, for real. But nothing, you know, 8 and 9, you really want to say, nothing, in or out of AA, changed my perception of myself and life and the world more than steps 8 and 9. The physical act of visiting the people and institution that I had difficulty with, to get in somebody's face and say, I'm here about the harm that I've done, there's things that I did that I should not have done, and there's things that I should have done that I did not do. And I'm here to try and make that right and then get out of there. It changed my perception of myself more than anything else. You know, 10, I got a great 10-step format from Bruce P., who's my sponsor, who was a member of this group, gave me a 10-step that rocks. It turns out that every time I have any kind of emotional disturbance at all, of any kind, I'm afraid. And it's always the same 2 or 3 fears for me. It's the same self-centered fear. So that troubleshooting fear, that's 10-step, becomes extension of the inventory in 4 through 9. And then 11, which again, you know, you can't really talk about too much. I find it difficult to explain step 11 without sounding, you know, whatever. It's difficult. It really is. You can say what it's like, but you can't say what it is. But the one thing I like about 11 is at the end of 10, it says, these things start to happen automatically. There's a healthy instinct starts to assert itself. I don't have to figure it out. Thank God. It's not so much like figure it out, and it becomes to emerge. The healthy instinct starts to rise up. And then 12, you know, working with other people. I was at PAX recently, and thanks, man. They said, there was a dude that was like, I don't help other alcoholics because they're sick. I help other alcoholics because I'm sick. Now, I try not to be confused about that. Now, there's a lot of things in AA that sound like a contradiction, but it's really not. And I love that about AA. What do they call it? It's like a paradox. It's this, but it's also not. And I just love that because it changes and whatever, it stays fresh. But this idea that I got to help other people because I'm sick, I don't like to claim sickness for myself. I don't like to claim insanity for myself. I'm still crazy. And in one sense, you could say we are recovered. I don't have a problem with that. I don't say that's wrong. Well, I've recovered from a hopeless condition of I can't stop drinking and I can't stop thinking about alcohol. But I could still absolutely be freaking Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Jackass, like in 2 seconds, if I don't stay on board with these guys. And the guys that I work with, my sponsees, the guys that I've been able to work with, when these guys take these concepts and principles and I see them install this as a way of life, not just reading it or talking about it, but when they demonstrate that toughness, the mental, the emotional and spiritual discipline of take this out of the book now and go and do it, it creates this feedback that, to me, it fuels the enthusiasm that I have. And that's the value, you know, of that. The rest of it, what? In all our affairs, that's what it is. What can you say? I will say that I can't. That being said, you talk about what the inspiration that you get from these experiences in my past. I cannot kid myself to believe that this experience that I have now, tonight, is going to keep me sober next week or tomorrow. I can't say that. I can't expect that. So I got to keep it moving, man. I'm gonna try. I try to do this every day. I was talking to my friend Linda last week. Guess what? We get to be here for this. Yesterday, Chinese New Year. Anybody? It's amazing. We got the new president is installed. The Steelers are in the Super Bowl. It's big for me. I'm from, Western Pennsylvania, represent. And we get to appreciate these things. Not just that I was there, but I'm awake. We're not half conscious. I'm not half dead. You get to pay attention, to this. And I appreciate that. So, and thanks a lot for asking me to speak here at Atlantic. I appreciate it. Thanks.